To Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Ecclesiastes 7. I have some sheets that represent the page we're on in our workbook. If you're interested in that, you can let me know. Bruce said he'd skip down the aisle and hand those out. Just kidding, Bruce. Bruce is recovering from knee surgery. If anybody needs a copy, chapter 7 is where we are. All right. We'll do a little bit of the color marking you'll see behind me on the slides. If you don't have the material, you'll be fine. We're just walking through the chapter. It's a pretty large chapter, 29 verses, so we'll need to get moving today. Let's begin by giving all the glory that we can to the Lord before we start our study. Our God in heaven, we bow before your throne today. We grasp at your feet. We seek to be near you. We are humbled by the idea that a creature with flaws like ours could in any way be admitted to the courts of perfection and to be in the presence of the Creator in your glory. But Father, you are amongst us, and you allow us to appeal to you, and it teaches us the value of the blood of your Son, that it would be great enough, strong enough, pure enough to make people like us eligible to be in your presence. Father, we want to use those opportunities. We want to make the most of them. And so today we're prayerful that our time in Bible study over the next few minutes and our time in worship and singing and praying and being together will be the full usage of the benefit of being in your courts. Father, we long for the day when we can see you face to face, we can see heaven. And Father, help us to live for that and use the wisdom of Solomon to keep us focused on the things that matter and not entangled with the futilities of life under the sun. In your Son's name, we make these appeals. Amen. All right. So one of the things we talked about very early on in Ecclesiastes is taking the 12 chapters and breaking it into basically two sections. I mean, you do have the beginning section of the first few verses, which talks about the scope under the sun and the question, what advantage, and the answer, vanity. And you have a little section at the end where it says, fear God and keep his commandments. But the major portion, the 12 chapters, how did we talk about, and you can reference back the first page if you have your notes, how do we talk about breaking the letter into two pieces? What are the first six chapters about, which we've just now finished? First six chapters. Okay, it's mostly not so exciting news. Brother Matt is right. It is the futility of life under the sun. It's talked about the fact that we live and we don't accomplish anything particularly new or substantive, and then we die, and there's a lot that we don't know, and there's a lot of unfairness. And so you spend about six chapters just sort of being enamored with the inconveniences of life here. So what do you think Solomon will try to do with the second half of the letter? First half, reality of life here. What's the second half about? Okay, I can help you out a little bit, Solomon says. Can't answer everything. You're going to see that right here in chapter 7. He still didn't get to the bottom of everything. But there are a lot of really wise ideas that can help you navigate this life. Now, in a sense, this is arbitrary. We've seen some of it already. We've been marking these recommendations throughout the letter. Even in the first six chapters, which was mostly about all this futility, there were recommendations. What is the basic recommendation that Solomon has been giving us on and off through these first six chapters? What does it sound like? What does he recommend? Okay. Live life as it is. Thank God for what you have. What else? Enjoy what you have. Live in the moment. Enjoy what you have. Give honor and praise to God for everything that you have. If we would just do that, it would change a lot of people's lives incredibly. So as we get to chapter 7, he really talks about some of those futilities we've examined, and then he lets us know some good recommendations. So that's where we'll be today. Part of what we're doing behind me, and I know it's difficult to see, this is a large chapter, so I had to pack in a lot of information. But what we're trying to do is a little bit of the markings along the way. I would say this in terms of the marking class that's coming up in January on Sundays. If you have been doing this and have enjoyed it, then you might enjoy the marking class we'll be doing next month. If you'd like to know more about how to do this, or you think there could be some value, but you've really hesitated to get going, you're definitely going to want to be a part of the marking class. But if this is the bane of your natural existence, and it almost single-handedly ruins your Sundays to see some preacher put a bunch of text on a board with coloring, that is not the class for you. Do not sign up for that class. There's going to be a great class offered in here, and you can be a part of that. But I want you to see that we really haven't left some of our themes that we've been looking at. Here are the first 14 verses of chapter 7, which is where we'll be. And there's our futility over there in verse 6. And there's our scope in verse 11, under the sun. And we're still kind of asking that question in green. Are there any advantages? What are the advantages? And what you learn in this chapter is, I mean, there may be a few, but under the sun, there are no absolute advantages because futility just continues to be a problem. But let me ask you this. What word appears over, I think, 8 times, over a half a dozen is what I was going to say. What word pops up 8 times in this short section? Better. The better phrases, you can do it. Oh, they're going to come in one at a time and take 2 clicks per. That is well planned, Chris. Talk amongst yourselves. There. They didn't format quite right, so they come out a little bit differently. But what you'll notice here is you have better all the way through. You have it a couple of times in verse 1 and verse 2 and all the way through. And so what you're going to see is, in the midst of a lot of troubles, and he talks a lot about those in this section, there's some basic better wisdom that can help you navigate this. The truth is, some things are just better than other things. And you're going to see that as we move along. And also noted here that we have is, although it didn't come out in the right spot, we have 2 references to God. The formatting's weird. It's a PC. What can I say? But here's what I want to begin with. Chapter 7, the first 20 verses. Circumstances of adversity run throughout this section. Not just the 14 verses you see behind me, but about the first 21 verses. There's a lot of futility and adversity. And what I ask you to do is note on your sheet the adversity phrases. I want you to note that he says, let me put together all the negative stuff we've talked about for 6 chapters, and I'm just going to throw it down in 20 verses. So what sort of adversity does he discuss in verse 1? I consider this to be adversity. Death. All right, he says, let's talk a little bit about death. Nobody enjoys that, so I'll go ahead and talk about that for a little while. Verse 2, mourning. Raise your hand if you enjoy the house of mourning. None of us do from the typical worldly enjoyment standpoint. If you haven't completed this material or you don't have it, just have your eyeballs glued to chapter 7. You'll find everything you need. Okay, we got death in verse 1 and mourning in verse 2. What about verse 3? Sorrow and sadness. It's going to be a great class. I know you're glad you came. Verse 4. Comes up again, verse 4. Mourning again. We had mourning in verse 2. We have mourning again in verse 4. How about verse 5? It's one of my favorite things. Rebuke. Love being rebuked. Chapter 7, verse 5 talks about when somebody corrects you and rebukes you. How about verse 7? A couple of things. I have. Say again.
Oppression.
I heard another wording here. Oppression and bribery. 2 things that tend to go hand in hand. Somebody oppresses someone else, and these guys take care of themselves at the expense of others. Verse 10. This is an enjoyable exercise, verse 10. What did they do in verse 10 of chapter 7? Longing for the past. How's that work out for you? Anybody really get a lot out of that? Comparing these days to former days and what is and what was. That's not a real enjoyable endeavor. Verse 14. Adversity. Verse 15.
A lifetime of futility.
Oh, that sounds great. I think I'll write a book about that. Lifetime of futility, which is sort of what this letter's about. I mean, Solomon lived his whole life, had a lot of things, did a lot of things, came out and said, in and of itself, this life is a lifetime of futility. Verse 15 again. What happens to the righteous, verse 15? They live forever, right? Always works out for them to the better because they're righteous? No, the righteous perishes. Verse 20. What reality is stated for us in verse 20? Yeah, sin. Sin for who, verse 20? I mean, only the bad people sin, right? Even the righteous have sin issues that they have to deal with. And then how about verse 21? Yeah, I got good news. Nobody's ever talked bad about you behind your back. Does that feel good? And preachers lie. Two things you just learned. People talk about us. And people are dishonest, and people do the gossip thing, and that happens. So this is 21 verses, and if you made that list, if not, you can do so later. You just see, oh man, that is sort of taking all six chapters worth of sad realities and piling them in. But here's what else is going on, and that's why you have the better phrases here, is he's saying, okay, but I'll tell you this. I can give you a lot of tips along the way that are really going to help you handle all this stuff. I can't change what it is, but I think I can help you handle it. For instance, look at verse 21. Servants are going to talk about you behind your back. What advice then did he give to people? Because this is a reality. What's the advice, verse 21?
Don't take it seriously.
Something about water and a duck and its back. I don't know. That's before my time. I don't know. Apparently it rolls off in all directions or something. Don't take too seriously what you hear, what words are spoken. I think I remember from about a chapter ago, what is one telltale sign? Telltale, another term that predates me. What indicates a fool? He's always talking. He's always talking about the situation. He's always talking about someone. He's a fool, and his many words reveal it. So don't take too seriously somebody who gets half their joy out of life by back here talking about you and everybody else. Just forget about it. So see what he does there in verse 21? He says, okay, I can't change that that's what happens, but I can help you change the way you interact with it and the way you deal with it. So here's what I want you to do with me. You've got 21 verses here. Only about half of them are listed behind me. I can add a few more here if you'd like. Yeah, it's getting better and better. Verses 15 through 21. And there's good, by the way, which is really similar to what we saw before. But here's what I want you to do. You have all these betters. So look back through verse 21 and find one of the betters and help us. Give us some advice, verses 1 through 21, about how to handle some of this adversity. What do you see there in verses 1 through 21?
Better to go to the house of mourning to the house of
all right, so we do mourn. Can't take mourning away. There is death. Can't take death away. So Kenny says, verse 2, it is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. Why did he say that?
What you're thinking of.
It's really easy to say, I hate death and I hate mourning and I'll never be able to handle it and it's just something I try to ignore. That's a fool's game. You know what's better? If you realize that even things like mourning and death have a spiritual purpose, they cause us, and Kenny's right, to consider that there is an end to every man, that my time is finite, and that I need to use it to the best of my ability. If it wasn't for mourning and death, we wouldn't know that. So there's some wisdom to help with adversity. Give us something else from the section. We've got eight betters and a good. Yes.
I like not dwelling on the past because that robs you of the beauty of today. But that's very difficult to do.
All right. Maybe verse 10 would go along with that. Why is it that the former days were better than these? It is not from wisdom that you ask that. She says when we're dwelling on the past and what was, it robs us from the value of the present. I think about when they rebuilt the temple. And all the older folks could do was complain that it didn't look as grand as the one that they had previously. Hey, I got news for you. It's gone. It doesn't matter how much you talk about it or how much you compare it. That is gone, and this is what you've got. So the recommendation of the letter, be glad in what you've got. Don't dwell on what was. I mean, that's great advice. We can't change what was, what is, or the difference between the two. But we can change the way we deal with that. That's what Solomon does in this letter. It's so awesome. He doesn't change the realities. He helps you handle them. Give us something else.
Better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than the song of your fools?
No. No, I disagree with that one, but let's move on to the next. No, she's talking about verse 5. It is better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for one to listen to the song of fools. First of all, what does that mean?
What is the song of fools? Tell you what you want to hear? Why do they do that?
Why don't they tell you the truth? I don't know. Nobody knows. Maybe it's self-preservation on their part. Maybe they just weren't listening and don't care and are trying to be cordial. But I don't enjoy being rebuked, being corrected. And some people look at being corrected and rebuked and challenged as this sort of dark spot in their year. When somebody has to sit them down and say, hey, you need to reevaluate that. That could be the brightest spot in your year. It could be the single most significant thing that happens to you all year long if the rebuke comes from somebody with wisdom. So something that's often perceived as a negative, it's a reality, we get rebuked. Can't change the realities. Can be a positive. I preached a meeting recently, and I knew there were three guys in the room who know the Bible. I don't know, whatever is bigger than a bazillion times more than me, if there's a number over that. And after I got done preaching, they all sent me emails. I'll just stop right there. A lot of positive things, a lot of encouraging things, some really interesting rebuke and correction and thoughts. I mean, rebuke maybe is a heavy word, but definitely challenge to reevaluate. And, you know, there's two ways you take that, but there's only one way that's right. If you respect the wisdom, you understand that I'm going to do it better moving forward, and I'll understand things differently and more completely because of their help. Can't change the fact that the rebuke comes. You can change from whom you take it and how you take it. All right? Give us something else from the text.
Verse 8 ties into that. If you took the rebuke with patience of spirit rather than with pride, you're better for it.
What do you think about the combination, Matt? I'm going to push on you a little bit. The end of a matter is better than its beginning. We get two betters in verse 8. The end of a matter is better than its beginning. Patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. Do you see a connection between those two? What Matt's pointing out in the second thing is being patient and weathering it and working through it, though it's not enjoyable to be patient and work through difficult things, is a lot better than haughtiness and flippancy. What about that phrase before it? The end of a matter is better than its beginning. Is there a connection there?
At the beginning, you may be wrong.
Okay.
You're going to be challenged to change something, rethink it.
At the beginning, you may be wrong. You've learned something, Martha. Yeah, right? You think about James 1, where it talks about enduring various trials. In fact, how does James open his letter? What an odd opening to a letter. I mean, I guess that's what you call like an introductory hook or something. How does James open his letter? Consider it what? All joy. Consider it all joy when you what? In trials. Encounter various trials. Consider it all joy when you encounter various trials. Knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and endurance will have its perfect result. Better the end of a matter, though it was a challenge to get through, to be stronger and better equipped than the beginning before you had to experience it at all. Now, that's not the way most people look at life under the sun. I don't like challenges. I don't like adversity. I don't want to go through it. I just want to rewind and get back to the beginning of it and never experience it. Guess what? You don't get that option. That's not an option under the sun. Better to look forward to what it can do for you at the end and how far it can take you. That's even better than how you started before you even had to deal with it. Yes, sir?
Like you said, the difference here is the end of the thing than the beginning thereof. That is for the God. All things work together for good to those who love the Lord. So the end of that is better than the beginning, but for the carnal man, he may be involved in some sin. The beginning of that may be very small, but it may grow through the time. And the end of that is much worse than the beginning.
Okay.
so the it applies to the gospel.
All right. Okay.
Anybody else on that? Give us another one. I heard a noise.
Yes, sir.
It's frustrating when you get the problem right in front of you and you worry about it and how you're going to handle it and you hear different ways. And when it's finally solved and it's ended, then it is much better than the frustration that you spent trying to figure it out.
All right. You know, Solomon gets to the end of this letter
and he realizes he didn't really have anything figured out, but I think he had contentment in knowing that the answers weren't out there and what the journey produced. I'm certainly thankful for what Solomon's journey produced at the end of the matter. Yes, sir?
This whole passage is really important to young people like myself who are still young in the beginning, if you will. And we need to be patient and willing to accept correction and be humble about it so that as we get older, we're better than we were before.
Okay. All right, good. Good, absolutely.
And I hope that everybody of all age still feels like they can do that. That's good. Anything else here? Yes, sir?
So are you saying the two parts to this verse are tied in their order? Is that what you're drawing down on, that in the beginning we're more patient and in the end we're more proud? I would think it'd be flipped.
I put a question mark at the end of it.
That's what's difficult about poetic language is the two that connect. For instance, verse 8, the end of a matter is better than its beginning. Patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. I think they go together in that you know that when you get to the end of it, you're going to learn something that will help you. So be patient and take that journey instead of being haughty and I don't want to listen to you and I don't want to go through this and sort of throwing it out. I think that's the connection of the two in verse 8. All right, let's talk a little bit about, well, let me make sure we've covered this. You have this list here of things. Before we get to verses 16 and 17, are there any other better connected pieces of advice that we've not yet covered? We should cover the first one. A good name is better than a good ointment. Is that always true? I don't know. I mean, if you ask somebody, you can have a great reputation or every essential oil ever made. I'll take the oil, you know. The oil is good. It helps me. It fixes things. He's not saying that the oils aren't good, but he's saying a good name is better. What does that mean, verse 1? I have a couple of questions on verse 1. That's just the first one. What does that phrase mean?
All right, well,
I'll be here when you're ready. So your reputation, right? Your legacy. Okay.
Yeah, it's really interesting that it makes you think about your impact on the world versus fixing a rash.
You know, when you got that rash, you just want to fix that rash, you know? And we think in the now and the pain and the here. But more important than the everyday fixes is who you are to the world and how you affect other people. And that ties directly into, here's my next question, how does that tie into the rest of the verse? The day of one's death is better, the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. How do those two things go together? A good name is better than a good ointment, and the day of one's death is better than the day of his birth. Yes?
The sermon we heard when Ryan was here, what are we leaving behind when we die? What he said, don't leave people confused when you leave this earth. And I think that's kind of what this verse is alluding to.
His whole series was about legacy. Look, when you're born, you haven't had to deal with any problems. I mean, there's really no problem that you know about. You're just a baby, right? You haven't dealt with pain and loss. Mourning, well, basically everything we listed in the first 21 verses, you haven't had to touch any of that. So how is life better at the end when you've had to deal with all of that? You give me a choice. You can be a baby and deal with none of it, or you can be someone who had to deal with all of it at the end of your life. Which one is better? Give me a baba. That's what we used to call it. That's tempting to say, but it's better to have lived this life and gone through the trials and the challenges and the difficulties, having kept a good name, having made a difference, holding and wielding the scars and showing people how to heal, than to have never experienced the pain at all. That's what this group of people in this room need to believe. Better to have hurt and helped than to be devoid of all hurt. That's the way Christians think. And it helps us. It just helps us process all of these inevitabilities. Hey, I have a little extra question to add. It is on your sheet there. And I think it's here. Yeah, it is. It's at the top of this page as well. It's just really interesting wording. Let's begin in verse 15. I have seen everything during my lifetime of futility. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness. You've all seen all of that before. So here's his advice. Do not be excessively righteous, and do not be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? Do not be excessively wicked, and do not be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you grasp one thing and also not let go of the other, for the one who fears God comes forth with both of them. And that actually did come in the right spot right there. So that's really important here, fearing God. Help me understand what in the world he's talking about here. Verse 15, I get. But don't be exceedingly righteous or wise, and don't be exceedingly evil. Is he preaching spiritual moderation? Be kind of righteous, but don't go like crazy all in righteous. And be kind of wicked, but don't, and you know he's not saying that. And that's why fear God is put in this text. It eliminates that as a possibility. So let's be beyond that. So what's he talking about here? Brandy, get us started.
In context, he's talking about his vain life. So he's talking about this earth. I don't think he's necessarily talking about spiritual righteousness, but like if I have a cause, if I want to save all the red-eyed beagles or something like that, then and I go on and live my life with, I think that's what he's talking about, is vain, vain righteousness.
Okay. Red-eyed beagle? That's good, that's good. Yes.
When he calls someone a fool, he's not saying that the person's not smart. It's completely independent of their actual wisdom or knowledge. When it says don't be overly wise, it's saying don't be wiser than you really are. Don't act wiser than you really are. Don't act holier art thou. Don't be excessively righteous. Don't be overly to either any of these extremes.
Okay. So he's talking about being pompous, maybe
being prideful, projecting your righteousness is great, because all you're really going to do there is ruin yourself. And by that, I think it means verse 1. You're going to ruin your name. You're going to ruin your influence. Maybe that's the idea. Paul?
When I see don't be overly righteous, I'm pretty clueless about just about every aspect of what that means. But one thing I can bring to the table is the idea of mercy. There is a time to show mercy. When I think of raising my kids, there are times when the right thing that they should have done is not what they did. But I don't punish them because I'm showing mercy. And when I hear don't be overly righteous, I think of punishing them every single time they do wrong and never showing mercy.
Okay. All right, that makes sense to me. I can understand that. Mark?
About the not being overly wise, I think sometimes we can be wise in our own wisdom and not be willing to learn and listen to others.
Okay.
Maybe you read the first 21 verses and you said, I get that the normal person is going to have to go through all that. And they're going to have to learn how to deal with it, and they're going to go watch this class to try to figure out how to handle all that stuff. But me, I'm pretty much super godly. And I've pretty much got everything figured out, and so I'm going to be able to sort of get around most of this. I'm not going to have to deal with a lot of the things that just normal people are going to have to deal with. My righteousness is so great that I've sort of unlocked the key to shortcuts. No, you have not. These are inevitabilities, and you will ruin yourself trying to be so wise and so righteous under the sun, which is the scope. That's so key. If these verses popped up in Romans or something, we'd be all confused. But in Ecclesiastes, not so much. He's talking about the realities of life under the sun. The things you listed in the first 21 verses, you can't out-righteous those things. But you can ruin yourself trying. So somebody says, all right, I'm going to go the other way then. If I can't change anything, I'm just going to be wicked. I'm just going to go do whatever. I mean, you can't change that there's bribery and oppression, and you can't change that there's death, and you can't change all that stuff. So I'm just going to go out and do whatever I want. What'd Solomon say about that?
Don't do that either.
You're probably going to die young. You may lose opportunities. Why should you die before your time? So what is he preaching here? That's what we really need to get to. He's not preaching be kind of godly. That's not what this is about. What's he preaching, Dan?
Well, in 19, wisdom strengthens a wise man. And in the context, a wise man is not the most learned man in the room. It's the person who is either humble or somebody who is acquainted, familiar. I don't know the right wording to say, but is being realistic about who he is, what level he's on, what not more or less than what he needs to be.
Okay. All right. End of verse 18.
End of verse.
The person that fears God is tempered with both.
Tempered with both. He's tempered with an understanding of both,
that there will be sin and there will be righteousness, and intermittent in all that are these unchangeable things. This class is not about changing what's going to happen. Some of it you can help. It's about handling what's going to happen. It's about the right approach to that, making the most out of it. Yes, sir.
To me, the Texas term for overly righteous is holier than thou. That's the kind of attitude that you'll see of someone who thinks they're better than others. By the same token, I've worked with a lot of smart people. But there are some who want to try to make you understand how smart they are by talking about it all the time. I would much rather work with someone that's not doing that than I don't want to be around a person that's trying to show his wisdom all the time.
That's a good observation, as if it makes him better than everybody else, and yet so many of the things in these verses are obvious to us all, going to happen to us all. Mr. Eugene.
I agree with Matt. Sometimes they get in the way.
All right.
Sometimes they get in the way. Yes?
Someone that's over-righteous might be someone that's always condemning and never encouraging.
Always condemning, never encouraging. Think about it in the context of life under the sun and the mourning and the difficulties and the trials that you face, and you need to be humble about that. All right, let's take a look at verses 19 and following then. You have that listed here, at least some of it, 19 down through this section. Look at what it says. It says wisdom. So we're not throwing out wisdom. We're just not saying that it's the answer to everything and it's going to change everything, but it does say this: wisdom strengthens a wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. Indeed, there is not a righteous man on earth who continually does good and who never sins. Also, do not take seriously all words which are spoken, so that you will not hear your servant cursing you. For you also have realized that you likewise have many times cursed others. Okay, let's stop in that section. Here's the question: how does wisdom in that section, verses 19 through 22, how does wisdom help you through your troubled times? From those verses, how does it help you?
Control your temper.
Sir?
It's how you control your temper.
Okay. Not going to lose control going through it. What else? Some great little nuggets here in 19 through 22.
Everybody in the room has different things that they're facing. We're not going to make a list of common trials, common struggles. Everybody's a little bit different. But wisdom can help you all in its own way. So what else do you see here, 19 through 22? We're going to control our emotions and our temper.
To heart things people say about you.
Okay, don't take to heart.
I'm going to ask a follow-up question. I'm going to make her comment and then ask a follow-up question. Then I'm going to come back to Miss Jenny.
Basically what she just said, the wise will take to heart all of these bad things that happen in life. And they don't put their trust in themselves and how they can fix it, but they can look to God and His Word and how He can fix it.
Okay.
If you follow His words.
All right, good. Look to God, God's wisdom. Let me ask you this. Why should you not let your whole life be wrecked when somebody back here is misbehaving and talking about you and making a mess? Why should that not be the end of everything for you? Why should that not weigh 1,000,000 pounds?
Because it empowers them if you continue to dwell on if people are ugly to you.
Okay. You give power that should not be assigned. What else? Yes, sir?
We need to realize that we sin. From the mistakes and sins that we make,
We need to learn from them. Okay. So wisdom will help us to learn from our mistakes.
Okay, wisdom will
help us learn from our mistakes. So here's somebody else making a mistake, though. They're talking about you. Why do I not let that be the most devastating thing that's ever happened? Raise your hand
if you've never gossiped.
Raise your hand if you haven't gossiped this morning.
That's good.
The look on your face is like you raising your hand. I get it. No, we didn't gossip this morning, but look. Life has righteousness and it has elements of sin, and it exists in you just like it exists in the world, just like it exists in them. We need to learn from our mistakes, but we need to understand, you also have to realize, verse 21, that likewise have many times cursed others. I don't know about many or cursed or however you want to assign that. But look, none of us are perfect here. Life's not going to work out the way you think it is. It's not going to last as long as you'd like, and you're not going to traverse it perfectly. So let's get some perspective here. Let's get some perspective on what we let weigh on us and what we don't, and where our fear of God comes in to get us through this thing. Dan?
Romans 12:18 seems to fit perfectly in here. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone.
Yeah, peace.
All right, good. Yes, sir?
As Christians are trying to live in a way, in a manner that's pleasing to God, in every step of life, the best of our abilities, and we should always be searching for knowledge to do better. But then, if we are doing that, we should not let it worry us about what somebody else says or curses us about.
Good point. Look, we're not talking about ignoring their sin. We're just saying, we're not going exactly what you said. We're not going to let that be this great weight on us. Life's got enough issues of its own without that. Let's get to this last section here, and I try to pile it all in, verses 23 and following, and let's see how this works out. We have God mentioned there. Question on your sheet, verses 23 and following. How is Solomon's search for understanding going? Gotta love what he's doing here. He said, I'm going to use my whole life, everything I've ever had, everybody I've ever known, everything I've ever done, and I'm going to try to figure it all out. Create some predictability to it. Plot a course that everybody can follow. How's it going for him so far? Give me some quotes from the text.
You know how it is.
The closer you think you're getting, the bigger it is. You know, you get close to something and you realize that it's farther away. Look at verse 23. I tested all this with wisdom. I said, I will be wise. But it was far from me. What does he ask in verse 24? Who can discover it? What has been is remote and exceedingly mysterious. Who can discover it? What does he say in verse 28? These are great little markings, by the way, if you just want to underline some stuff.
He said, I have not found.
Verse 27, behold, I have discovered this, says the preacher, adding one thing to another to find an explanation, which I am still seeking but have not found. It's like finding all these blocks. And you know you got all the blocks there and you've accumulated all the blocks and they're all different colors, or maybe puzzle pieces would be better. You know you have all 500 puzzle pieces there on the table. You counted them. They're all there. What's the picture? I just have a bunch. Look, it took most of my life just getting the puzzle pieces on the board. I have no idea what the picture is. I know you don't like hearing that. I don't like that. I want to believe that I can get this whole thing figured out, and I can be smarter than the next guy, and I can understand, and I can invest this way, and I can learn that, and get this education, and I can do this, and I'm going to get the full picture that nobody else can get, or very few people. And I'm going to write a book, and you're going to buy it. Look, you're talking about your soul and heaven. The picture has already been put together for you. But you're talking about life here in this? It's never going to come together. And as soon as it does, by the way, Solomon says, in a moment, somebody can flip the table on you. And you got a bunch of pieces on the floor again. I have to be living for something more than life here. And I have to use what I know about the soul and God. God is mentioned twice in this section. To try to help me do the best I can. Solomon's a lot smarter than me and you. And he didn't find the answer of what the picture is supposed to be like. And how it can be for everyone. Last question, dangerous waters. In this section on wisdom, and maybe this is what he was talking about, and our time is up. What things has his search taught him concerning women? Y'all finish with it. I don't see any kids in the back yet. I'll take an extra 30 seconds. So he's saying, I don't know. And we all know that's what he was talking about the whole time was women, by the way. He only had 1,000 of them. You want to learn a woman, you pick one. That'll give you plenty to do for the rest of your life. Plenty of things to research and talk about. What did he learn about women in this text? Just point out one thing and then we'll pick it up next week. What did he learn?
This is going to be in my thing, talking with the young girls, because it's a warning to men what women can do. And he says that they can capture you like chains. Their hands are like chains.
Did he write about that?
In other places? In the Proverbs he did. He wrote about that. The young man without sense, traveling in the middle of the night. And she comes out to him dressed as a harlot, boisterous in spirit. What do I learn? Women are very powerful. And when evil, they're extremely dangerous. Extremely dangerous. Extremely dangerous. So men, choose your women wisely. And women, know your power. And be godly, because you are very, very powerful. That's what Solomon learned. Actually, we know that from the end of his life, don't we? The women pulled his heart away to foreign gods. All right, our time's up. We'll look at it again next week. Let's start with that next week. And then please be prepared for chapter 8.